Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'm reading from the online edition of the Atlantic Magazine. All of the articles I'll read today have been published in January of 2025. Here's a sampling of what I'll be going through. A wider war has already started in Europe. Altadena after the fire. The consensus on Havana syndrome is cracking. And reckless driving isn't just a design problem. I hope you enjoy today's show. We'll begin with a wider war has already started in Europe. Putin's not-so-quiet sabotage campaign against European democracies, by Phillips Payson O'Brien. For the past 3 years, Russia has used missiles and drones to locate and destroy vital infrastructure in Ukraine, power plants, dams, electrical transmission lines. Everyone understands that these attacks are acts of war, no matter how steadfastly President Vladimir Putin describes them as part of a special military operation. When Russia targets other European neighbors, though, the West resorts to its own euphemisms to avoid directly acknowledging what Putin is doing. Last month, the undersea power cable EstLink 2, which connects Estonia with fellow European Union and NATO member Finland, was suddenly cut. The EU's top foreign policy official described the incident somewhat dryly and without explicitly blaming Russian agents. It was, she said, merely part of a pattern of deliberate and coordinated actions to damage our digital and energy infrastructure. Obviously, cutting a power line is a less overt form of aggression than the full-scale invasion that Putin launched in Ukraine. The common thread, though, is that Russia is using force to undermine a recognized country's independence and its ability to fight back. Undersea cables have been vital to the sovereignty of Estonia, a former Soviet republic that borders Russia, and desperately needs to maintain power and communication channels that are free from Moscow's control. Soon after EstLink 2 was sabotaged, Finnish authorities seized the oil tanker Eagle S, which was en route from St. Petersburg, Russia, to Egypt. Registered in the Cook Islands in the Pacific Ocean, the ship is likely part of Russia's so-called Shadow Fleet, a collection of foreign-flagged tankers that Putin's regime uses to sell Russian oil and skirt international economic sanctions imposed after his invasion of Ukraine. The Eagle S, however, apparently had a covert military purpose as well. Investigators discovered that the vessel was crammed full of advanced surveillance equipment, which used so much power that the ship suffered from periodic blackouts. Finnish authorities concluded that the Eagle S had dragged its anchor across the Baltic seabed for dozens of kilometers in an attempt to break the EstLink 2 line. Still, in this and other cases across the continent, European officials seem terrified of admitting what is happening. Authorities in multiple countries are investigating parcels that spontaneously caught fire or exploded in the custody of cargo airlines, perhaps in preparation for a broader operation that would threaten many large aircraft. Saboteurs have targeted a number of other strategically significant assets in Europe: munitions factories, crucial rail lines, along with civilian infrastructure such as warehouses and malls. Investigators believe that Russia is behind the attacks, In December, the EU imposed sanctions on certain Russian individuals and entities in response to recent sabotage. Still, the official announcement declined to use the word war to characterize Moscow's activities outside Ukraine. Instead, the EU condemned Russians' destabilizing and malicious actions. The inability to describe acts of war as acts of war is part of a culture of distortion and denial regarding the subject of state-sponsored violence. Over generations, policymakers have created many subclasses of conflict: cold wars, police actions, hybrid wars, cyber wars. Different euphemisms serve different purposes. Putin prefers special military operation because he doesn't want to publicly admit that he is waging a brutal war on Ukrainians. Many in Europe avoid describing Russia's sabotage campaign outside Ukraine as war because they'd rather not have to do anything in response. European officials would be better off honestly admitting the reality of what they are confronting. Putin's invasion of Ukraine is only the most conspicuous part of what looks like an ever more globalized war. Late last month, an Azerbaijani passenger jet was shot down from the sky over Russia and forced to land in Kazakhstan. North Korean troops have been transported thousands of miles to fight and die on European soil. European governments have dithered over how much to help Ukraine resist Russia's invasion, and they have no clear strategy for deterring or limiting the sabotage campaign now happening on their own soil. Acknowledging that Russia is engaging in acts of war would not oblige the EU or individual countries to immediately retaliate with military force. But the term war has a way of concentrating the mind, and using it might make European leaders think much harder about defending themselves when they cannot rely on the United States. Since the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991, and arguably since the defeat of Nazi Germany in 1945, democratic Europe has been predisposed to think about war as an issue for Washington to handle, not as a problem requiring their own leadership. European states might provide some soldiers and equipment, but do not have the burden of any serious planning or strategizing. That lax attitude is no longer tenable. Every leader on the continent needs to understand that Putin wishes to upend the entire European order, and that the United States is no longer trustworthy as a long-term ally. President-elect Donald Trump is openly disdainful of many governments in Europe and seems willing to walk away from America's role as the continent's protector. Although European leaders have largely refused to think about war, the EU's member nations and other democracies on the continent still have all the prerequisites for military power. Although the economies of the United States, China, and many developing countries are growing much faster, the EU, Britain, and other European democracies together have a population of about 500 million people and account for about 1/5 of world GDP. EU member nations maintain military forces with some of the most advanced equipment in the world. The combination of Putin's aggression and Trump's indifference should be an opportunity for Europe to take charge of its own defense. The first vital step in this realization is to acknowledge what's already happening. Call a war a war. And that ends the first column. The author, Phillips Payson O'Brien, is a professor of strategic studies at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. The title of his article was "A Wider War has already started in Europe. The second article today is Altadena, After the Fire, the pain of one of the last middle-class towns in Los Angeles, by Xochitl Gonzalez. On Wednesday morning in Highland Park, Los Angeles, dawn never broke. The morning light that normally streamed into my rental house simply shifted from pitch black to gradations of orange-brown as smoke from the Eaton Canyon fires billowed over the hills. Outside my window, a woman used the flashlight on her phone while walking her dog. My own dog and I barely made it around the block. The soot-filled air was dry and pungent, and the winds, those relentless winds, smacked us with a combination of dry pine needles, fallen bark, and chunks of ash. Most of my neighbors wore masks as they loaded their cars with shopping bags and suitcases. By the time we got back, all the phones in my house were buzzing with evacuation alerts. We were a full house, three middle-aged adults, a six-year-old, and a naughty dog, mine. The night before, after losing power in her home in Altadena, my best friend and my goddaughter went to kill time in classic L.A. style by driving through their local In-N-Out. Power outages from the Santa Anas are not unusual in L.A., and despite the Palisades fire raging across town, they were trying to act normal, perhaps the only way to psychically survive in a city prone to fires is to push the constant threat of imminent natural disaster out of your mind. In any case, by the time they got their burgers, the street was illuminated by flames, the night sky hot yellow from Eaton Canyon, just a few blocks away. They drove the 15 minutes to my house, where we immediately lost power too. Her husband hunted down every candle he could get his hands on in a drivable radius. In my living room, we texted friends and neighbors, checking on their homes and kids and evacuation plans. Outside, the sound of the wind was terrifying because of the howling, but also because of the danger it represented. Each gust potentially carrying embers this way, taking out homes and businesses, and eventually, in the case of Altadena, most of a community. Altadena is an unincorporated community of about 40,000 residents, nestled in the foothills of the San Gabriel Mountains. Having spent a lot of time there, I get the appeal. Even something as mundane as putting the trash out at the right time of day is a chance to experience majestic levels of beauty. When people think of life in the hills around Los Angeles, they tend to think of millionaires and movie stars. And, for sure, there are some splendid homes and a sprinkling of celebrity residents, such as Mandy Moore there. But Altadena is racially and economically diverse, and middle-class life remains at its center. It was founded by two well-off brothers from Iowa in the late 1880s, and workers with jobs in the nearby city of Pasadena moved there. After a long battle against redlining, black homeowners began arriving in the 1960s. This made Altadena one of the first integrated middle-class communities in Los Angeles, and residents today are particularly proud of this history. One of those residents was Wilford Duncan, the first black fireman in Pasadena. In 1960, Altadena was 95% white. In 2024, it was 46% white, and the bulk of the rest of the population was made up of black and Hispanic residents. This was partly why, when my best friend and her husband decided to move back to her native California to raise their black and Latina daughter, they chose Altadena. The other parents that met at their daughter's school included local business owners, house cleaners, and government employees. They made friends with their neighbors including an older public school teacher who'd raised her family across the street. On Tuesday night, her house burned to the ground. In recent years, and particularly since the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic, when the rise in remote work let people work and live farther from downtown and West Los Angeles, home prices in Altadena have soared. But newcomers haven't been house flippers or private equity firms running Airbnbs. They've been families looking to set down roots, like my best friend. A remarkable 78% of the households are owner-inhabited. It's not unusual to meet people who've lived in Altadena for decades, or even residents whose ties to the town go back a generation or two. That's part of the strong community atmosphere. Neighbors make cookies for neighbors and invite one another over for drinks. Kids trick-or-treat down the street in unchaperoned groups. And families have post-parties after the Rose Bowl parade. The local economy was exactly that, local. Minus a few fast food joints and big chain pharmacies, the neighborhood was as close to mom and pop as one can find today. For 25 years, kids from Altadena and Pasadena have studied with Sipus Shaleen Hearing at Two Dragons Martial Arts. Locals who met at the Rancho, Altadena's premier dive bar, became so close that they were known to spend holidays together. If you were bored, you could take your family to the Bunny Museum and browse more than 30,000 items of collected rabbit memorabilia. Every single one of those businesses burned to the ground this week. One local official told NPR that probably half of our small businesses are gone. Five of Altadena's public schools suffered substantial damage, as did a couple of private schools, a senior center, a public golf course, a country club, several houses of worship, and a yet-to-be-determined number of homes and apartment complexes. So far, more than 5,000 structures have been reported as lost. An unofficial Google Doc tracking the destruction has been going around, and the pace at which it was being populated on Wednesday was terrifying. Each new address correlated to a person you knew or a business that made you love where you lived. On Facebook, a woman was looking for an older man named Willie, who lived near a particular intersection. "I don't know his last name," she wrote. "I speak to him on my daily walks. I'd like to make sure he's all right." Neighbors were texting one another videos of block after block of devastation. So many people are in the same situation as my friend, evacuated and unsure whether their house will still hold. 10 hours after she and her family arrived at my house, they learned they'd have to flee again when my neighborhood was evacuated too. I'd always judged people who, faced with a natural disaster, chose to stay in place. But experiencing the situation firsthand, I understood. We were a ragtag group. Who would take us in? But how could we split up? For almost an hour, we stared at one another, paralyzed. Eventually, we heard from a generous friend in Palm Springs who had room for us. Into the cars we went. But others did stay, or have dared to venture back. They hose off the lawns of the absent to keep the floating embers from catching, offer to break into homes at risk and grab personal photos or other belongings, and take pictures of the damage that's left behind. As we drove past the halo of black smoke over L.A., we saw tractor trailers turned sideways by the wind. Text messages continued flooding in, announcing home losses and relocation plans. Most hope these moves will be temporary, but depending on insurance payouts and school closures, they might wind up being permanent. We hope to see you all again one day, a father wrote to my friend's dad group. His family was heading up north to stay with relatives and knew that they might not be able to return. Some kids leaving town with no return date in sight FaceTimed classmates to say goodbye. Still other children don't yet understand what's happened to the place they call home. All of Los Angeles, regardless of socioeconomic class, is sharing in one deep traumatic loss. Schools, cultural institutions, the businesses that make hometowns feel like home, so many have burned. But there's a secondary sadness hovering over middle-class Altadena, and certainly over anyone on the margins of poverty. Altadena will build itself back. But how? And for whom? On the Altadena Facebook group, residents are attempting to guide one another through FEMA applications and encouraging everyone to file their insurance claims quickly. But in one-on-one conversations, no one is naive. Everyone anticipates pushback from insurance companies and payments that will be a fraction of what their homes were worth or would cost them to rebuild. Will the teachers whose homes burned down still be able to afford to live there? What about the firemen? Where will all these people go in a region that is already plagued by a shortage of affordable housing? Even if one isn't familiar with Naomi Klein's term disaster capitalism, most Americans are, by now, well-versed in its hallmarks. A natural disaster occurs. Locals are forced to evacuate and small businesses close. Their returns are delayed, sometimes indefinitely, by failures to restore infrastructure, such as schools and electricity, quickly enough. They might be stymied by red tape and bureaucracy. Needing stability for their families, they are forced to build a life elsewhere. To stop wanting to go home. In their place, developers and private equity swoop in, reshaping these areas for the rich and ultra-rich. This has happened after Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans and Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, and Superstorm Sandy in the coastal areas of Brooklyn and Manhattan. Los Angeles's economy is already in a precarious state, with a housing crisis and a glut of workers in the TV and film industry. I can easily imagine that without government intervention and intentional counter-planning, something similar will happen here. Surviving financially in the Los Angeles was already challenging. How many families can manage not to just get by, but to completely rebuild their lives? When my best friend moved here, I was immensely depressed to lose her from my life in Brooklyn. But in the subsequent 2 years, I've visited many times, sometimes for weeks-long stints. I've come to love it here so much, I'd call it Brooklyn West. It had that same neighborly generosity and quirky moxie that had gotten squeezed out of my hometown. One blank street coffee and luxury high-rise at a time. It's painful to imagine that Altadena could now, in this moment of speculative opportunity, suffer the same fate. Accusations of local government incompetence are flying around this week, nearly as forceful as the winds. But the local government has work to do now. Federal aid is crucial, but so is getting schools reopened quickly and expediting the rebuilding of established small businesses. Altadena needs not vultures seeking to maximize profit, but creative developers who can protect and expand the kind of community Altadena was. When they are done with mourning, I know the residents will do their part. That ends the article. The author, Sochi Gonzalez, is a staff writer at The Atlantic and the author of its newsletter, Brooklyn Everywhere, about class, gentrification, and the American Dream. The title of her article was Altadena, After the Fire. I'll take a brief moment to remind those of you that may have tuned in late, this is the Atlantic Magazine program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'm reading articles from the online edition of the Atlantic, all of them published in January of 2025. This next article is titled The Consensus on Havana Syndrome is Cracking. After long denying the possibility, some intelligence agencies are no longer willing to rule out a mystery weapon. By Shane Harris. 2 years ago, U.S. intelligence analysts concluded, in unusually emphatic language, that a mysterious and debilitating ailment known as Havana Syndrome was not the handiwork of a foreign adversary wielding some kind of energy weapon. The long-awaited finding shattered an alternative theory embraced by American diplomats and intelligence officers who said they had been victims of a deliberate, clandestine campaign by a U.S. adversary, probably Russia, that left them disabled, struggling with chronic pain, and drowning in medical bills. The intelligence report, written chiefly by the CIA, appeared to close the book on Havana Syndrome. Turns out, it didn't. New information has come to light, causing some in the intelligence community to adjust their previous conclusions. And a new report reopens the possibility that a mystery weapon used by a foreign adversary caused Havana Syndrome. At the White House, senior Biden administration officials are more convinced than their colleagues in the intelligence agencies that Havana Syndrome could have been the result of a deliberate attack by an American foe. The geopolitical consequences are profound, especially as a new president prepares to take office. If Russia, or any other country, were found culpable for violent attacks on U.S. government personnel, Washington would likely feel compelled to forcefully respond. Starting about a decade ago, a small number of Americans, mostly federal employees, and many of them working in intelligence, reported similar experiences in Havana. In an instant, they heard a painful ringing in their ears, followed by intense pressure on their head and disorienting vertigo, which was often followed by nausea. Some of the victims developed long-term problems with fatigue or mobility. Other officials later reported similar symptoms while in Russia and other foreign countries, and many concluded that they had been the victim of a deliberate attack with some kind of acoustic weapon. Early signs of a fracturing consensus on Havana Syndrome emerged this past November when half a dozen victims, all current or former intelligence personnel, gathered in the White House Situation Room at the invitation of senior staff members on the National Security Council. The officials hosting the meeting had read the same intelligence that underpinned the earlier assessment, published in 2023, and thought that the authors had been too quick to rule out a deliberate attack. They also felt that the victims had been maligned, misled, or not given adequate medical care for their ailments, which had caused some of them to stop working. Several people who attended the meeting told me. In a sign of respect, the hosts invited one man, regarded as the first known victim of Havana Syndrome, to sit in a chair at the head of the Situation Room conference table, which is normally reserved for the president. The ostensible purpose of the meeting was to help write a guidebook for the incoming Trump administration on cases of anomalous health incidents, the anodyne label that the intelligence community has adopted for the syndrome. But the officials also had an update to share. New information undercut the 2023 assessment and would leave the victims feeling vindicated. Mather Bitar, a senior NSC official responsible for intelligence matters, told the attendees, according to some people who were present. The attendees stressed that Bitar never disclosed any classified information, nor did he specify exactly what new intelligence had been discovered. The White House officials didn't explicitly say a foreign power was responsible for Havana Syndrome, but the victims felt that the president's team believed that this was possibly the case, and that they intended to push the intelligence agencies to reconsider their position. Mark Polymeropoulos, a CIA officer injured in Moscow in 2017, who attended the meeting, praised the NSC as a long-standing champion for victims and credited them for their doggedness. Part of what led to the intelligence community's earlier decisive conclusion about Havana Syndrome was the assumption that the existence of an energy weapon, a device that could cause the kind of injuries Havana Syndrome victims suffered, was implausible and not supported by evidence. But the officials and victims assembled in the Situation Room considered whether this assumption was really valid. An independent panel of experts, convened by the intelligence community, had suggested that an energy weapon could use pulsed electromagnetic energy, particularly in the radio frequency range, to cause these symptoms. Some NSC officials have long believed that the experts' opinion didn't get enough attention and was unduly overshadowed by the CIA-led report. I was briefed on that intelligence report when it was released in 2023, and at the time I was struck by how unequivocal the analysts were in their judgments. In my experience, analysts are reluctant to draw definitive conclusions and try to leave some wiggle room. The analysts in this case were more declarative than any I've ever heard. However, they did allow that the intelligence community remained open to new ideas and evidence that might emerge. For example, if a foreign adversary were seen making progress developing an energy weapon or the technology to build one, that might change analysts' thinking. That appears to have happened. Today, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence released an update to the 2023 report. The intelligence agencies aren't saying a foreign actor is to blame for Havana Syndrome, but they are no longer so confident that one is not. Two intelligence agencies have now shifted their judgment to reflect a greater possibility that a small number of cases indeed were caused by a foreign actor, an intelligence official told reporters in a briefing. The agencies have examined new information that foreign actors, he didn't say which, are making progress in scientific research and weapons development. One of these intelligence agencies, again he didn't name them, determined that the chances that a foreign actor has used some novel weapon or a prototype to harm a small number of U.S. government personnel or their family members are roughly even with the odds that one had not. The other agency identified a roughly even chance that a foreign actor has developed a weapon that could have harmed people, but determined that any such device was unlikely to have been deployed yet. This change may seem subtle, but it is significant. To move from the earlier position that no weapon existed and no deliberate campaign targeted American personnel, to a 50-50 chance that these things might have happened is a remarkable, if narrow, development. Five of the seven agencies that contributed to the report did not change their position, so the shift reflects a minority opinion. Sources close to the issue told me that one of the agencies that changed its tune is the National Security Agency, suggesting that intercepted communications may have revealed something about this foreign actor's research efforts. White House staffers and a few intelligence agencies aren't the only ones who think there's more to the Havana Syndrome story than previously understood. Last month, Republican Representative Rick Crawford released another report following an investigation by the House Intelligence Committee. The intelligence agency's conclusion that foreign adversaries aren't responsible for targeting U.S. personnel is dubious at best and misleading at worst, the report said. The Trump administration will have to decide how to respond to the new analysis, if at all. Concern about foreign attacks, and particularly care for victims, regardless of who or what made them sick, has broad bipartisan appeal. But in the closing days of the Biden administration, intelligence officials are making clear that they aren't all on the same page. That completes the article, "The Consensus on Havana Syndrome is Cracking," by Atlantic staff writer Shane Harris. Our next article is titled, "Reckless Driving Isn't Just a Design Problem." Road safety activists convinced themselves that law enforcement was unnecessary, by Gregory Schill. Ever wonder what would happen if the police just stopped enforcing traffic laws? New Jersey State Police ran a sort of experiment along those lines, beginning in summer 2023, about a week after the release of a report documenting racial disparities in traffic enforcement. From July of that year to March 2024, the number of tickets issued by troopers for speeding, drunk driving, and other serious violations fell by 61%. The drop, the New York Times reported last month, coincided with an almost immediate uptick in crashes on the state's two main highways. During 2024 as a whole, roadway fatalities in New Jersey jumped 14%, even as they dropped slightly nationwide. The obvious conclusion? The withdrawal of enforcement in the Garden State led some motorists to drive more recklessly. For better or worse, law enforcement is necessary for traffic safety. In the past decade, though, an ideological faction within the road safety movement has downplayed the role of law enforcement in preventing vehicular crashes. This coalition of urbanist wonks, transportation planners, academics, and nonprofit activist professionals has instead fixated on passive measures to improve drivers' vigilance and conscientiousness, narrower lanes that encourage drivers to slow down, curb bump outs that widen sidewalks and shorten crosswalks, and other physical changes meant to calm vehicular traffic. For good reason, progressives have been alarmed by racial inequities in law enforcement, and New Jersey's experience to some degree validates those concerns. Troopers eased up on writing tickets because they apparently were unhappy about outside scrutiny of discriminatory practices. But the episode is also a forceful demonstration of the value of enforcement as a public service. If you take coercive measures off the table, you must agree to share the road with people driving under the influence or at double the speed limit. In many communities, the effort to promote safer driving through the physical redesign of streets comes under the banner of Vision Zero, a movement whose goal is to eliminate all traffic fatalities. But the design-first approach has become a substitute for individual responsibility rather than a complement. Historically, design was only one ingredient in Vision Zero. In practice today, it is just about the only one. Enforcement is expressly denigrated by even mainstream organizations. In 2022, when launching an initiative called Dismantling Law Enforcement's Role in Traffic Safety, a Roadmap for Massachusetts, the nonprofit Livable Streets Alliance claimed that traffic stops do not meaningfully reduce serious and fatal crashes. Some grieving families in New Jersey might disagree. The umbrella group Vision Zero Network, another nonprofit, asserted in November that despite some achievements associated with law enforcement, there is ample historical and current evidence showing the harms and inequities of some types of enforcement, particularly traffic stops. This is clear and troubling. The question is what conclusion to draw. Some activists even criticize animated speed cameras, which require no intervention by potentially biased officers because of the financial burden on low-income drivers. Shrugging off driver misconduct is the wrong prescription for racial and economic inequities. People in disinvested communities disproportionately become victims of reckless driving. Black pedestrians face a mortality rate more than double that of white pedestrians. More than anyone, vulnerable people need the vigorous protection of the law, not an abdication of that paramount public service. The U.S. has the deadliest roads in the rich world. About 40,000 Americans a year now die in traffic, and a growing proportion of them are pedestrians and cyclists who don't even benefit from our car-first paradigm. I understand why safety advocates favor solutions beyond writing tickets. As I have previously argued, driving is both cheap and a prerequisite for daily life in most of the country. Vehicles are large, heavy, and under-regulated. Laws against their misuse are inadequate, and roads are wide, conducive to speeding, and unsafe to cross on foot. Transportation planners and legislators have gone too far in reshaping our landscapes and our laws to accommodate the automobile, with damaging consequences for racial equity and other priorities. Yet the growth in vehicle deaths is difficult to explain simply in structural terms. For starters, nearly all of the surge in U.S. pedestrian fatalities since 2010 comes from collisions at night. Changes to street design simply do not address the leading causes of crash deaths: failure to wear a seatbelt, drunk driving, and speeding. Today's Vision Zero incorporates some useful insights about design's power to influence behavior. The goal of reconfiguring streets is to nudge people toward better driving, much as calorie counts on menus are supposed to promote healthier eating. These ideas, seemingly everywhere in the early 2000s, draw on a pop version of Nobel Prize-winning behavior economics research. With the benefit of additional evidence, we now know that their effectiveness is easier to show in a TED talk than in real life. In the case of traffic safety, the overemphasis on nudging has warped our thinking. For example, street design essentialism presumes that the most dangerous driving behaviors are unconscious, when we know that many drivers actively choose to be reckless. No country that has improved its safety record, including Sweden, where Vision Zero was born in the 1990s, has made it infeasible to drive a car dangerously if you want to. What our peer countries have done is pair targeted design improvements with targeted and even intensified enforcement campaigns. American street safety activists used to demand better enforcement. Now, rather than focus on curbing dangerous conduct by individuals, many of them cast about for bigger villains, placing the blame on high roadway mortality on indifferent state highway departments and greedy automakers who profit from oversized SUVs. In this view, individuals are merely passive users of the transportation system, hostage to invisible forces. Coupled with activists' obsession with street design, this approach frequently leads to a weird 21st century form of progressive patronage, commissioning like-minded nonprofits and consultancies to produce reams of reports and unrealistic renderings, holding interminable, democratically unrepresentative listening sessions, and minting white elephant projects that defy parody. Street designs have their own pitfalls. For starters, they are far easier to plan than to execute. Changes to the built environment must run the NIMBY gauntlet twice, first to get built, and then a second time to withstand the post-installation backlash. All of that became clear in the 2010s, when conditions were uniquely favorable to infrastructure building. Today, borrowing costs are several times higher, and the construction industry is short about a third of the workforce that it had before the coronavirus pandemic. Meanwhile, input materials have skyrocketed in price. The combination has doubled road building costs in some cases. New tariffs, if implemented, would exacerbate these problems. Beyond street design, what should communities focus on to improve safety? Half of vehicle occupants killed by crashes were not wearing their seatbelt. Drunk driving is a factor in nearly one-third of crash fatalities. The same is true of speeding. Not all speeding is the same, though. Going 55 miles an hour in a 50 zone generally isn't the problem. Super speeders, motorists driving, say, double the limit, are likely overrepresented in traffic deaths. Street design, which seeks to make the average driver more conscientious, does nothing to target the antisocial behavior of outliers. Rather than justifying a permissive approach to reckless driving, social justice demands a more focused campaign. Just who is helped by letting reckless drivers, many of them affluent suburbanites, speed through working-class neighborhoods? Speed cameras can't do everything. They may not deter super speeders, for example, and they're useless against stolen cars and counterfeit plates. But where they are effective, they can remove bias from enforcement. There is no contradiction in saying that neither dangerous driving by private citizens nor abuses of police power will be tolerated. Road safety activists should redirect some of their energy away from promoting the design industrial complex and toward targeting the deadliest behaviors. Design is only a tool. Just as beautiful office renovation cannot boost morale at a failing company, many grave transportation safety problems cannot be solved through design. Let's start a new era of safety by ticketing unbelted motorists, talking more about super speeders, and seizing their car and license, and renewing the decades-long push against driving while intoxicated. America's enormous traffic death rate is a complex problem. As New Jersey has recently reminded us, enforcement must be a part of the solution. That completes the article. The author, Gregory Schill, is a professor at the University of Iowa College of Law. His article was titled, "Reckless Driving Isn't Just a Design Problem." The last article today is titled, "The Easiest Way to Keep Your Friends," by Serena Dye. It started as a friendship of convenience. Kyra and Nino, a husband and wife, had lived in the same building as my husband and me for years. We interacted occasionally, as congenial acquaintances do. Then the pandemic hit, and well, you know, we had time, we had proximity. We exchanged food and drinks and books and laughs. And one day I looked up, and we were all honest-to-God, genuine friends, the kind who water each other's plants and know each other's Szechuan takeout requests. But then the world opened up. We had offices to go to and errands to run and other friends and family to meet with. We saw our neighbors mostly in passing. "Hi, how are you? It's been too long. We must hang." And I realized that we'd fallen into a trap, the exhausting tangle of calendar gymnastics that plagues many adult friendships. Busy with everything else, we hadn't spent quality time together in months. The hardest part about adult friendship is by far scheduling time to see one another, especially when trying to plan for a group. Thursday's bad for one person, and Saturday's not good for another. Monday would work, but hold up, the restaurant we want to try isn't open that day. Let's wait a couple of weeks. Somehow, though, the day never comes. Your friends forget to follow up, or maybe you did. Either way, can you even call one another friends anymore? I tend to catastrophize because I am dramatic. I am a terrible friend who deserves no one, I think, or I will die alone, pining for old buddies who fell out of touch because we were tired and busy. But after some bouts of agonizing, I hit on a simple solution. Set a recurring date on your calendar to get together, and then stick to it. Some people might find this tactic a little soulless and formal, the same way that some couples deride the idea of scheduling sex. Yet when your life is ruled by your phone and nothing gets done unless it ends up on a to-do list, booking repeat friend dates is practical, a way to carve out real time, not just for errands and work, but also for engaging with the people you love. Setting a friend routine is not a new concept. Whether they do poker or bingo nights, tailgates or Dungeons and Dragons campaigns, Americans have long found ways to regularly socialize. What I'm proposing, however, is more casual, more intimate. Parties have their place, as do bar trivia and other big group activities. The problem is those events will almost inevitably involve people whom you find annoying, which means that, if you're like me, you'll still be left craving time with the people you do like. A recurring calendar date lets you set the terms. You can be with the people you want at the time you want, and enjoy the comfort of hopping straight into easy conversation. Bad small talk avoided. Relationships need repetition and structure to grow. They need rituals and habits. This is why many adults say it was easier to cultivate close friendships in school, when they saw the same people every day, and why so many people idealize the warm vibes of Cheers or Friends. Same bar, same cafe, same time, same people. Recent research has found that although plenty of Americans have friends, many of them aren't seeing one another. Partly this is because institutions that used to encourage consistent, more seamless socialization, such as religious and civic groups, have largely declined in popularity. Without those conduits, planning hangouts became a form of social labor, the kind that for many people can easily feel like a chore. And because proactive communication is a requisite for scheduling, the work frequently falls on the same individuals over and over again, usually the naturally organized, the extroverted, and, let's be honest, the women. But these people are also busy. Ask too much of them, and the whole exercise risks becoming a recipe for resentment. Put together a recurring date, though, and bam, the drudgery of when are you free disappears. I can understand why some people might find the idea a little cringe when you know that your friends' schedules are already booked with back-to-back activities. Asking for permanent space on their calendar might feel like an imposition. This is a big, vulnerable, define the relationship sort of ask. A do you like me as much as I like you conversation? Imagine the embarrassment if a friend were to say no, or worse, to gently push off the question until you eventually realize that they don't feel quite the way you do. And I'm going to have to end here because we have run out of time today. The name of the article was The Easiest Way to Keep Your Friends by Serena Dye. This has been the Atlantic Magazine program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader today. I've been reading articles from the online edition of the Atlantic, all published in January of 2025. I hope you enjoyed the program. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to the premium programming offered by Sun Sounds of Arizona on a 24/7 basis. And if you've missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then click on Podcast or Demand Podcasts. You'll see a list of programs available. Hopefully you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.